by Dr. Sam Estes, who's manager of the Communication Systems Group of the Research Division of IBM at that location. His co-author, Ray Kirby, who's with us, is the manager of Advanced Technology Systems Development Division of IBM in the same location. Sam?
Communication requirements for computers. If I were to ask, say, 12 people out of the audience for an answer to that question, no doubt I would have 12 answers. And one of the reasons why I would have 12 answers is that those 12 individuals are looking at it from a different viewpoint or a different background or different problems that they have encountered. Therefore, in order to have something that would be more specific for us to discuss today, we have chosen a particular environment. It is clear that communication requirements for computers depend on the task that the computers are performing. If we can have the first slide, then we'll get a description of this environment. We want to consider data processing systems that have these functions, where there are multiple data processing services, and in a moment we'll have an example which will clarify this a bit further, where there are many user interfaces to these data processing systems. The word user interface is an important concept in our discussion today. We have at the location where the user is located a terminal. Linking him to the data processing service is a communication network or system. But the user interface is what the user sees of the data processing system as it is reflected to him through the characteristics of the communication network and of the terminal interface. So that this is more than just an I/O unit. It is actually what the user sees of the data processing service. We'll consider both clustered and dispersed terminal communications or user interface environments. The particular I/O devices for the user environment would be both simple keyboard devices all the way up to dynamic displays. In the systems that we're considering, the cost of the communication network is a significant factor. And although not an absolute necessity by assumption to simplify the situation, we consider that the system is under the control of a single organization. Now let me introduce with the next slide a hypothetical company that will illustrate some of these characteristics. The WX, Y, and Z company. It is a company that is dispersed, that is scattered through a large area, but which is involved in using certain data processing services in its day-to-day activities. We assume that this is a progressive company and that it will grow, and therefore the ability to expand the network to meet the growth requirements of the company is a significant factor. May we have the next slide, and we'll see an example of some of the data processing services. You'll notice that opposite each service, there is a number of terminals that address that service for that organization. If you would recall the number of terminals that were in the previous slide, then you'll see that in some cases, a given terminal is addressing several services from a given location. As I remarked before, we assume that these services are involved in the day-to-day transactions of the business in this company. Now, these are pretty much current applications that you see on the board. Your imagination can take you wherever you will and what these might be in the future. Now, given a situation like this where we assume that the services have been established and that the company is operating on the basis of them, it would be only a little bit of time before somebody comes up with the idea, why not put them all together? What would be the advantages of that? Possibly we could get increased availability of services because of the multipath or the redundancy of equipment that would exist in a network. Possibly we could get increased efficiency if the peak load factors of the different services are out of phase. But the primary basis of trying to do something like that is economic. Now, let me comment that the details of the figures on the last two slides are not necessarily ingredients of the topic under discussion, but the idea is to try to get you to think in the environment that we're thinking of in the discussions to follow. We want to be concerned, then, with multiple service data processing systems and the communication requirements for those systems, where there are many users, where there's a common community, and where cost is a major factor. Now, this is a complex communication system. It's somewhat scaled down from that which the common carriers deal with or which the military deals with, but it's still large enough in its own right to be treated from a significant set of system complexities and requirements. It depends on the characteristics of those applications that are being served or the data processing services being offered, on the collective and the individual characteristics of those applications. Now, in such a system, what is the function of the communication network? The system consists of a user population and certain data processing centers. The function of the communication network in this environment is the accurate and timely transfer of messages between the user and the data processing services. A number of things we would like to know about this system. In order to obtain efficiency, we have to be able to handle and to characterize accurately the message traffic. May we have the next slide, please? We need to know the who, the what, and the when of the conversations that are going on in the communication system serving these multiple data processing services. We want to know who talks to who. That is, what users are addressing what services, and we might also allow users to talk to users and computers to computers also, or data processing centers to each other. In addition to that, we need to know what they say. This is somewhat different than the telephone environment, where the characteristics of the network have been tailored to the gross characteristics of say, speech transmission, but without regard to the specific detailed content of that speech. We need to do this in order to be able to efficiently allocate transmission capacity in this system. Not only do we want to know who talks to who and what they say, but we want to know when they talk. A business of this sort is cyclic in nature, from day to day, from week to week, month to month, and even year to year. And we need to understand very accurately how these cycles run in the different services and how they would map into each other in terms of efficiency. Literally, we need the time series statistics of the message traffic. Now, if we could hold the next slide for a moment and have the lights. There are a number of factors in addition to this basic requirement of being able to handle the message traffic, which are important in such a system. One of these is the response time requirement. The response time requirements are different for different data processing services, and they are different even for different stages within the same service. These can range from a few, about 100 milliseconds, up to a considerable number of seconds, depending upon the application. The important factor there is that the person at the interface not be interrupted in his thought process of the task that he is performing. He must retain the continuity in that task. A further discussion of a large category of response time requirements for these type systems will be found in Robert Miller's paper that was presented in the 1968 Fall Joint Computer Conference. It's not clear at all that these kind of requirements can be met within the function of a general purpose network. A high volume inquiry system, for example, utilizes a number of factors in being able to meet response time requirements for that system. It can depend very heavily in a single application on the operator's capability to determine that something has gone wrong and therefore to respond to that. It can also place the load of handling the bookkeeping efforts of the network on the transmission side of the network where there is the least volume. That is, if the inquiry and the response are unbalanced in terms of message length, then it can put it on the side with the shorter message structure. There's another very important factor relative to this user interface, the characteristics of the data processing system that the user sees, and that's the ability to keep this user informed of error recovery status. He needs to maintain continuity in his task, and he needs to maintain confidence in the system. He can do this by getting simply a request for retransmission, but in many applications, a request for retransmission would be so disruptive to the thought process of the individual in his task that it would destroy the effectiveness of the system. This can be accomplished in the system only if buffering is placed somewhere so that those messages that are entered into the system can be retained and held until it is determined that they have reached the proper destination and have performed the proper function. These buffering systems are buffering entered into the system either at the terminal or at nodes in the network have lots of implications regarding the overall architecture of the system. Now, as we mentioned in the environment we're considering, the company is progressive and will grow, so that there is a necessity for designing the system so that there is growth, and then also so that the integrity of the system is preserved for that capacity which is available in case of disruptive conditions to be allocated to those people who absolutely require it to maintain the essential functions of the business. This introduces the question of priority. If, for example, on a closed system without priorities, you've tried to put data in the system, data transmission through a system that was designed primarily for voice traffic, you know what a disruptive situation that can be, and how that kind of situation can load the system down. There has to be a method of including priorities in the system. Among the services and among even users in the same service may be necessary. Another aspect which has been mentioned by the previous speakers is that of modularity. It's necessary not only for the initial implementation of the system, but to provide a fail-safe basis and to provide for maintenance of the system, and to provide for incremental growth in the system without excessive investment increments when the growth is desired. Now, in summary, related to the applications aspects of the system and the characteristics of those applications, the fundamental one is that of message traffic. Then there are certain requirements related to the way the user sees the system, the user interface. It's necessary that there be responsiveness to that individual and that he be informed of the status of his task within the system. And then there are those situations related to the growth of the system and the maintaining of the integrity in case of disruptive conditions. Let us turn then from the applications-oriented aspects to technologies. Let's have the next slide, please. On this slide, we see a list of the major components of the system. There have been a considerable number of prophecies concerning how the technology that impacts the cost in these individual component areas will develop, particularly that of LSI. There have been prophecies about when that impact would occur, which one of these areas it would impact, and on what time scale the impact would occur. One thing is certain at this point, and that is that there will not be a simultaneous and uniform impact of all of these component areas because of these technological developments. Therefore, if a choice in the implementation of a system exists among these components, it will obviously favor those which offer the greatest cost advantage. Now, the cost of the system components can affect the system in two ways. First, there are the basic data processing functions that are being offered. This is essentially the question of to communicate or not to communicate, to have a local system or to have some remote centralized service. Now, some of the services that we consider are by their nature centralized, such as database inquiry systems. And the requirement to establish these centralized services can have a significant effect on the economic decision on whether other services that are not necessarily centralized by nature should be included in the overall system. The second way it has an impact is on the implementation, assuming that it is desirable to use a communication-based system in the applications, on the impact of how the system is implemented. We have in that situation all of the classical problems that have been discussed here and in the management and control of networks in the session yesterday regarding the architecture and the control mechanisms, the control philosophy for the network itself. The essential element from the viewpoint that we're taking here is the economics of one system over the other. Now, further than that generalized thing, I'd like to consider two specific developing technologies that I think will have a significant impact on the way the system is configured. The first of these is the trend from multiprocessing and time sharing. A number of years ago, it was desired to make data processing systems more efficient. The first step in that stage was to overlap the I/O and the compute of a computer system. This evolved into multitask systems and then into time-sharing systems. We have the same problem in a communications network in two ways. We have the question of an idling communications link. An individual is sitting at a user station performing some data processing task. He has a certain transmission capacity allocated to him while he's doing that, but because he's scratching his head or he's drinking a cup of coffee, or he's waiting for the system to perform some complex computational function, the transmission link itself lies idle. So that there is the question in that sense of more accurately, more appropriately allocating the transmission capacity to the user according to what he actually needs. This is the reason we want the information on the message statistics. The second one, which we can see to some degree in the next slide, is the fluctuation of demands upon the data processing centers. Multiprocessing systems can be adapted to changing load requirements. Back one slide from that, please. Should be one in between those two. Okay, we'll go ahead without it. Hold that one for a moment, please. The situation I'm considering, let's suppose that we have a headquarters operation and a research and development operation who are addressing a data processing service, and that during the normal course of events, the normalized traffic, say, between the headquarters operation and the data processing center, we'll call 1, and between the R&D operation and the data processing center, we'll put a number 0.75. Now let's assume that we come to a report period at the end of the month. Progress reports are due. All of the scientific people are stopping on the scientific computation. Now they got to write their progress report. So all of a sudden, everything shifts very heavily to the text processing. And particularly where we are report-oriented at the headquarters operations, the factor might be significantly higher, even 1.5 to 2 times the normal peak activity that would be required. Now, there isn't a great difficulty by using partition systems and assigning another partition to the particular task at hand, or by using time sharing or multiprocessing techniques, provided the total compute capacity is available, in which case if it's not, priorities would come into existence. There's not too much of a problem in allocating the data processing functions to those tasks. But we have now a completely different pattern of flow of information in the network. So we need some method of being able to allocate a change in capacity of the network to match the capacity of the data processing system as the demand patterns switch from time to time. Several ways we could do that through the overconnected net would be as suggested in the ARPA discussion. We might even provide for switching in additional transmission capacity between points in the net if that was found to be desirable. There might be a number of others, such as buffering and transmitting the data to smooth it out, if that were allowable in the context of the particular services that are being utilized. But this is an important aspect of this multiple application environment, to make the communications network respond to the changing load patterns as we have attempted to do with the data processing systems. Now, another aspect which I think will have a very significant impact is, what does digital transmission mean to this type of system? There is no question but what all digital transmission would be a desirable goal, such that data would come to every node or in the network and retain its logical significance, so that the control would be placed in the line of the message transfer. While it is a desirable goal, it is not a desirable goal at any cost, because the key emphasis in the overall implementation is economic. Now, short of all digital transmission, what do systems like the T1, T2 carrier systems mean to this type of system? If we'll have that last slide again now. The 50 kilobit service, which corresponds to approximately one voice channel, can be configured into approximately 330 150 baud channels, which would be appropriate to serve an input function from a keyboard. On this slide, we have a group of user interfaces with a probability of activity along the abscissa, P, probability of activity. And then on the ordinate, we have the number of terminals that can be served, such that the demand never exceeds the number of channels that are available in the 50 kilobit link, with probability 0.1 for the lower curve, and probability 0.01 and 0.05 for the upper curve. This points out the fact that one of the key elements in the utilization of the digital transmission in interactive type systems is the ability to get the data from the user interface into the pipe, you might say, in a manner that would be expedient and not overly expensive. The real question there is, what is the cost per bit to the guy who's actually using the service? Now, in summary, let's have the lights and we can turn that slide off, please. In summary of this part, we've seen that there are much overlap and many trade-offs that are possible in the implementation of the data processing services, both between the question of communicate or not communicate, and then within the communication system itself, of the application of data processing technologies and communications technologies to efficiently implement the system. And then we have seen how developing computer architecture and the possibility of using digital systems could lend to the ability to efficiently configure these type systems, where the emphasis is on the cost. Now, I've tried to set an environment for you that is hypothetical, but I believe plausible, even in terms of today's kind of needs. We found that the basic requirement is the ability to handle the message traffic, but that there are characteristics of the tasks that are being performed to which we must give significant attention. We must preserve the user interface characteristics, because that's the way the user actually sees the data processing system. If it does not respond to him in an appropriate manner, that he has confidence in it, then he will not use it and he will not want it. We have to provide for the growth and for system integrity so that we can serve the essential functions under adverse circumstances. And then in the area of technologies, the trade-off between data processing and communications technologies in the implementation of the system. Now, this is a relatively small system environment compared to some that exist in the world. However, it's quite large, it's quite complex. It has significant requirements which are applications-oriented, so therefore they will depend on the things that people are doing in the particular operations. And the overall requirement for communications for computers used in this context is the ability to engineer systems which will meet these requirements of applications with a cost emphasis on the system. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. I think that we've heard a lot from one side of this camp now, the computer types, and it's now our opportunity to hear from the a view of computers by the communication people. You see on the program that Dr. E.E. David, Executive Director of Research in the Communication System Division of the Bell Telephone Laboratory, is scheduled. He will appear on the panel, but the presentation will be made by two other Bell Telephone Laboratory people. R.W. Lucky will begin the presentation, and he will be followed by Mr. Warren Cornell, also the Bell Telephone Laboratories. And after they have finished their presentation, we'll all gather up front and let you take a shot at us. I'm especially grateful to the speakers thus far for allowing time for the communication people to have a word here. Bob Lucky?
I'll give you an extra couple of minutes here.
I really don't need them. Thanks, Emily.
It's a real privilege to be able to play the role of at least half of Ed David here this morning. I think there's a certain amount of awkwardness to it, like two people trying to play the role of a dancing horse in a stage show. But I was thinking of that, and I thought, at least in that case, I've got the right end of the horse this morning. The way we're going to work this, Warren Cornell, who speaks after me, is going to talk about the systems aspects of what some of the telephone people are doing to facilitate data transmission over telephone facilities. I'm going to talk something about the hardware aspects of this, the changing technology and the way we go about transmitting data over a telephone line. So this is going to represent, I think, quite a change of pace from what you've seen before. And in case there's any further doubt, I think I'm the guy who works in Professor Zestrin's supermarket and over where the empty shelves are. Now, I could go about this like a Fuller brush man and bring out all my shiny new pictures of our chrome-plated data sets for the forthcoming year, but that would bore me, and it would probably bore you people something awfully, too. So I'd rather talk about the principles and the evolving philosophy of how we go about using the telephone network for data transmission. And let me start by talking about what we're doing in the way of modulation and demodulations, too. To more efficiently use the telephone channels. Can I have the first slide, please? Can you see the bottom of that thing? Is it possible to raise this thing at all? I don't care about the top of this, but I'm interested in the bottom. If we turn it upside down, that might do it. Let me go ahead in that case and I'll fill this in. I'm trying to portray here the evolution of higher speeds and I picked a voice telephone channel right now. And it's only a matter of a decade or so that we've really been interested in transmitting data over telephone facilities. For many years previous to that, the only thing we had was telegraph speeds, which were lower than 150 bits per second over voice lines. Then, only a little more than 10 years ago, people started using a binary frequency shift keying to transmit data, and that you could get rates up to about 1,200 bits per second over a switched telephone line. And this was the first real modulated data signal that was used on telephone lines. Now, shortly thereafter, people were interested in more efficient transmission, faster transmission. A four-phase transmission was introduced, and it went up to about 2,000 bits per second on voice telephone lines. Now, in the past few years, the Bell System and other companies have begun offering sets which utilize the line more efficiently yet. And these I've characterized as being multi-level AM systems, so we're back to amplitude modulation, just like you get in a regular radio, in commercial AM radio, except that they do differ a little bit, and I want to go into that. Now, there are two ways you go about getting these higher speeds. I'm going to mention these briefly in a kind of a non-technical way to show you what is involved and why these things cost more than the others did. We have to have a reason for that, I suppose. There are obviously two ways that you can get higher speeds in data transmission. You can either, we're sending information by pulses, and you can either send more pulses per second, or you can let each pulse represent more information. Now let me look at both of these for a minute. If we have the next slide, we see a typical binary signal shown on the top. We have possible two pulses. A one is a positive going pulse, and a zero is a negative going pulse, so that a binary signal 10110 would be shown there at the top. Now, you can double that speed of transmission without increasing the rate of sending pulses by just letting there be four pulses instead of two different pulses as shown in the bottom, so that we have four possible amplitude levels. And then you see in the same amount of time we can send twice the amount of information by using these intermediate levels. Now, this is the sort of thing which is being done to get higher speeds now in multi-level systems. So we're just the pulses convey more information than they used to. Now, if 4 is twice as good as 2, why don't we go on to 8 and 16 and 32 and so forth? Well, you run into troubles, because the more of these amplitude levels you try to put in, the harder they get to distinguish at the receiver. And the things that get in the way of our distinguishing the pulses are noise in the telephone facilities, which is really quite low, and this so I'm told. And so I'm told to say. The other thing is the self-noise that the pulses themselves create, because they get a little bit distorted in going through a telephone line. Now, the next slide just shows how a little bit distorted might be. In the right-hand side of the slide, you see a what I'll call a good pulse. It has regular zero crossings, if you're interested in that kind of a thing. That is, the pulse itself goes through zero at the times when other pulses are going to be transmitted. And you appreciate there's a whole train of these pulses. And when we're sampling one pulse to see what information is being transmitted, we don't want to see any of the others. So the pulse has got to go through zero at the right times. And one on the right-hand side does that. But unfortunately, when it goes through a telephone line, you might get something like the one on the left-hand side coming out, which doesn't go through zero at the right times, and which I'm going to call a bad pulse. Now, it's been suggested to me a number of times that I don't call them bad pulses. And I've never really found a successful euphemism for bad pulse, so let me just simplify it. Actually, quite seriously, it's miraculous that the pulses come out as good as they do when you consider what is involved in transmitting a pulse through the telephone network. It really is. It never ceases to amaze me. But nevertheless, we do get a bad pulse out. Now, I've shown in the bottom half of these slides what we call eye patterns, and probably half the people in the audience know what an eye pattern is, and the other half aren't going to find out this morning, probably. Actually, it's really something very simple, but I have such a complicated way of explaining it that no one understands it when I finish. So I just kind of give up. But what it really is a super, it's a lot of these pulses put together and just thrown up at one time. And what you see is in the right-hand side of the picture where we have the good pulse, the pulses don't interfere with each other much, so that if we were to look at any individual sampling time where we get either the positive conjunction of all the signals at the top or the negative one, you wouldn't get much interference from the signals themselves, and the only thing that gets in your way of distinguishing them is the noise. But on the left-hand picture, you see that because the pulse is distorted, there's no time at which the receiver can really look at the received wave and see just either a plus one or a minus one, because the pulses are overlapping with each other. Now, you can see on the left-hand side that if this is what binary signals look like, if we tried to send four different levels, four amplitude levels, that you would never be able to tell them apart. You just have gibberish over here on the left-hand side. So that a typical telephone line won't support, because of this distortion, higher levels than just binary transmission. But this is the sort of thing that, unlike noise, can be corrected. I mean, it's something that once you find out what the telephone line is distorting and what characteristic way it's distorting the pulses, then you can correct that distortion with an equalizer and essentially transform the bad pulse on the left to the good pulse on the right. And the new data sets do that adaptively, because every time you dial a line, you get a different kind of distortion. So the new kinds of the new generation of data modems being built by Bell System and others have what we call adaptive equalizers that adaptively compensate the bad pulses to make them look like good pulses, and then you can go to four levels and to eight levels. And around eight levels or so, you run into where the noise begins to hurt you, so you can't go any further than that. So here's a way of tripling the data speed. by using multi-level signaling and using some adaptive compensation for the signal characteristics, for the channel distortion. Now, let's look at the other way of going faster. Suppose we send the pulses closer together. We send more pulses per second. Well, what happens then is the energy that goes out of a telephone line tends to get spread out more and more. And the faster you try to send the pulses together, the wider the energy band, the wider the bandwidth of the signal, transmitted signal, becomes. And if that gets too wide so it can't fit over a voice telephone line, then your signal just doesn't get through. And it gets mutilated when it comes out the other end. So there's a limit to how close you can crowd these pulses together. Now the next slide shows the typical spectrum that you get the energy distribution that you would get from an amplitude modulated signal. Now on the bottom, those of you who can't see, is just the frequency axis, and the ordinate here is the energy density. Now the vertical line in the center is what we'd call a carrier frequency. It's our tone that we're going to modulate to send data. Now in ordinary amplitude modulation, you would get a spectrum as shown in the AM here, which goes on both sides of the carrier. And the faster we pump the pulses, the wider this gets, and that limits how fast we can transmit. Now in the new types of systems, what we do is we cut this spectrum right in two, as shown in the dotted lines here, which is called a vestigial sideband. In other words, this spectrum is really twice as wide as it should be. So if we can find a way of getting rid of the redundancy in the spectrum, we ought to be able to send pulses twice as fast. And we simply get rid of it by putting a filter in, which cuts out half of the energy here. But then at the receiver, you've got to put that missing energy back in. And that is a further complication of the new terminals and part of why they're more expensive. And it does make them a little bit trickier and not as rugged as the slower speed systems, say, using frequency modulation might be. So that what I want to say is that we're pushing, in the two ways that you can send data faster, we're pushing in both of these to the limit. Now, if I could look in the future a little bit, in this evolution of higher speeds, I really don't foresee any higher speeds coming out for a long time over voice telephone lines. The same evolution now is going on in wideband, where now you can get up to 108 kilobits per second over a group band channel. But I don't see very much in the way of higher speeds coming out, because we're approaching theoretical limits in both of these areas, in both of these ways of getting higher speeds. This does constitute now only about half of what the information theoretic capacity of a channel would be. But that's an awfully good percentage, and frankly, no one really knows how to go about getting speeds much higher. But we don't know how to do it, but we do know we can prove conclusively that it's very hard to do. And that's important from an economic standpoint, because it means it's unlikely that there'll be the economic incentive to go about trying to transmit at higher speeds. Furthermore, when you get to these higher speed systems, you run into small imperfections in the channels of a nonlinear nature, such as companions, which are used for voice transmission, which make it very, very difficult to get much faster than we're going right now. So I don't think you'll see much higher speeds, but you will see a change in the way the data sets themselves and modems are built, a different philosophy, so that hopefully they'll be cheaper, they'll be smaller, and all these kinds of things. And I'll get more into this a little bit later. But there's the other thing going on right now, that too, and that is we're trying to get the most out of the present facilities that we can, the lowest error rate, the highest rate signals. But there are an awful lot of people working into trying to change the facilities, so the facilities of the future will have a greater capacity for digital transmission than what we have right now. Now, I appreciate this is a slow process, because it is a tremendous investment and plan out there in the telephone system. It's not going to be changed overnight from what it is today to an all-digital system that so many people would like to see in the near future. But right now, and for the past several years, we are installing at a fairly prolific rate digital carriers. In fact, the next slide shows the rate of introduction of a T1 carrier. Now, T1 is a pulse code modulated system carrier, and it's used between switching centers up to about 50 miles. So it is a short haul carrier. But the main thing is that you see an awful lot of these things going in, and the rate here is going up almost exponentially, the rate at which they're being put in. This is an all digital carrier. And the thing that kind of strikes you right away too is that every voice channel in this digital system uses up 56 kilobits. So for the same economics, if you could get directly on this digital carrier, you could get 56 kilobits over a voice channel. And it would be all digital. There would be no modem involved. Now, this is the trend of the future. The new carrier systems will be largely digital. Right now in exploratory development, we have long-haul carriers. In fact, they're approaching development status. And then if you go a little bit further in the future, we have very high-capacity systems like the waveguide, which has, by present standards, a fantastic capacity to transmit information. And even if you look past that, we have people working on a laser, so that the facility itself is changing toward a much higher capacity system and toward a digital system. All right, let me talk now about errors. They do happen, and for the most part, the modem hasn't done much about correcting them. Error control in a system has been done by the computer, by the data processing equipment, and almost always in the form of detection retransmission systems. Largely in the past, it's been, say, a single parity bit in an ASCII character. Or in magnetic tape transmission, it would be horizontal and vertical parity checks. And you just check the parity, and if it doesn't agree, you retransmit the offending portion. Some of the new systems, the ARPA system that was mentioned earlier by Larry Roberts and some of the IBM BISync systems, use a cyclic parity check, which gives you a lot more redundancy and more powerful check. But it is a system which essentially works detecting errors and then asking for retransmission. Now, this isn't... this is very good in many cases. It's a very good thing to do, and it provides very clean transmission. But in some cases, it's not so good. And particularly with the higher speed modem, sometimes the error rate will be a little too high. And when you're dialing up a switch telephone line, you're liable to get, with a certain probability, a line which has an error rate which is maybe a little too high for your detection retransmission system. So you'll spend a lot of your time retransmitting and you won't be getting through much good information. Another thing, you may not be able to put up with the round-trip delay time involved in detection retransmission. Now, this might be particularly true in satellite transmission, where you have a synchronous satellite to go up to, and in wideband transmission, where the data rate itself is very high, so you'd have to store an awful lot of bits to provide for the retransmission of a particular record length. For some of these reasons, then, some of the new philosophy in modem design is to put an error control system within the modem itself, and to correct some of the errors, not by using detection retransmission, but just using redundant checks in the data itself to actually correct errors at the receiver before being passed on to the data sink. Let me just show you one example of this in the new Bell system offering. The error control looks like something in the next slide. If I would just look at the top here, I'll show you just how this code is generated briefly. This is hasn't got the block structure that many of you may be used to, because it's a recurrent, a convolutional code. If you just look at the top now here, the basic word length is 24 bits, and it consists of four separate sub-blocks, each of 6 bits. 5 bits of information followed by one parity. Then you get 5 bits of information, one parity, and so forth. Now, as a result of this, you have 24 bits altogether in the whole block, and 20 of them are information, 4 are check bits. And the ability of this code is to correct any single error which occurs within any 24-bit span in the received data. So that anytime you get one error within a span of 24 bits, this goes ahead and corrects it without bothering anybody else and passes it on as corrected to the data processing equipment. Now, that sounds fairly powerful. I mean, 1 out of 24 is certainly a very high error rate. But it's, as many of you know, it's not as powerful as you might think, because errors tend to occur in clusters on telephone lines. They don't. If you get one error, you're liable to get some brothers of it right nearby. And so that you may have 2 or 3 errors if you get one within this 24-bit span. And we have a way of getting around that, which is very popular now in new systems, both in telephone applications and other applications, called interleaving the code. And this array of interleaving is shown on the bottom, if you've been trying to figure it out while I've been talking about the other thing. Instead of transmitting out this 24-bit word, we store them. We store quite a number of them, 127 of them at the transmitter before transmitting any of them. So you have 127 of these words are stored in a giant matrix that's shown on the bottom. And then instead of transmitting the words out in the order in which they came in, we transmit the bits out in a vertical direction. In other words, you go down the first row, down the second row, and so forth. So they're being transmitted in a different order than the original data. Now what happens if there's a burst of errors occurs in the telephone lines? The burst occurs in a vertical direction here. And then when you reorder these back at the transmitter, you see the burst gets broken up. And so that each word, which is the words run horizontally here in the matrix, each word has only a single error, provided there are less than 127 errors in a row. So by this... I want to get back to that, because that's a very interesting point. This system, then, using a very simple single error correcting code, then can correct up to 127 errors which occur in a row. And this does sound fairly powerful. It sounds powerful to me if you can correct 127 consecutive errors without bothering anybody. I mean, why should you ever make any errors at all? And unfortunately, the fact is, no matter how big an interleaving array you go to, no matter how many errors you're prepared to correct in a row, there's always a burst that's bigger than that. And this burst comes along every now and then. And when it does, you make an awful lot of errors. And so the error rate reduction that you get, even from something that sounds as powerful as this, is not as much as you might think. And the next slide shows how much it is. Now, I'm really sorry that most of you probably can't see the abscissa here. I'm sorry that we can't raise it. But on the abscissa, we have the average error rate, and it runs somewhere between 10 to the minus 2, 1 in 100 on the left-hand side, and 10 to the minus 7th, or 1 in 10 million on the right-hand side. So that you would hope your data would be toward the right-hand side here, 10 to the minus 5th or 10 to the minus 6th. And the ordinate here, can you focus this a little better? Well, can't have everything. The ordinate here shows the percentage of switched telephone connections which would meet this requirement. Now, for example, let's take the 10 to the minus 6th error rate. If you need that kind of error rate, this says that there we go. Now stop. That both the 201A, which happens to be the 2100 bit four-phase modem, I don't know why we don't call it a Mustang or a Corvair or something like that. I don't even remember these numbers myself all the time. But the red curve, anyway, that is the kind of thing people are used to, so the philosophy is they're willing to accept that kind of an error rate. And if you can see at 10 to the minus 6th average error rate that about 30% of the channels meet that. In other words, 30% of your channels will be that or better as you just dial them up arbitrarily over a telephone line. And 70% will be worse. If you're willing to put up with a 10 to the minus 5th error rate, then you see that some 60%, 70% of the channels actually meet that. Now, the black curve shows a new high-speed modem, which now is transmitting at 3,600 bits per second over voice telephone facilities. And it actually, you can get options up to 5,400 bits per second over switch lines and up to 10,000 bits per second on private lines. But you'll see that there the error rate is worse, so that only about 60% of the lines meet the 10 to the minus 5th error rate. But now when you put in this little error control scheme, you can see in the blue curve now that 80% of the channels now would meet the 10 to the minus 5th criterion, and 60% would meet the 10 to the minus 6th criterion. So what you've really done is you've lifted up those marginal calls. Those calls that before had, I mean, a lot of calls are going to be good whether you had an error control in there or not. But what you're doing here is you're making a much higher percentage of the calls become acceptable, have a good error rate. Now, another phenomenon which occurs, which is not really shown here, is that the errors now occur in a different distribution with the error control. The average time between errors is increased by several orders of magnitude by the error control. Errors are much further apart on the average. But when you do get an error, you tend to get quite a few at one time, and there's that. I think if we look at the continuation of this trend in the future, a data set will run for years without making any errors, and it'll just have a complete nervous breakdown and just have to send for a new data set. Now, if I could look now at the trends in error control philosophy, it looks really kind of bright. I think many people have doubted the use of error control for many years because it's been so complicated. But error control is something that's inherently digital, and it goes in very well with the new LSI philosophy, so that right now the storage for this matrix is put on a single chip. And people are talking about building coders and decoders on single chips because it's something that can be done all digital and it's very amenable to the LSI philosophy. Furthermore, advances in the theory of this, we're finding new, more powerful codes which are easier to correct all the time. So I think it has got a fairly bright future. One immediate trend is that at the Bell System and other companies, people are looking at what we call adaptive decoding procedures. And I think this is the general trend for the future, too, that you'll see more adaptivity in terminals. So they're able to better tailor themselves to an individual connection that they might get. Now, an adaptive decoder in this case would have two options. It would say to itself, well, errors occur here both in bursts and they occur sort of scattered around randomly. And maybe I ought to be prepared to correct either kind of error. So the decoder has the capability of decoding either as if the errors had occurred in a clump or as if they were scattered. And this makes it much more powerful. In fact, the dotted curve, if you're right in the front row where you're standing where I am, you can see a dotted curve above the blue curve, which shows that a comparable adaptive system using the same complexity of the blue one would have improved this quite a bit. Now, Let me just say here in finishing a few words about the way these things are implemented. The trend, of course, is toward LSI, but it's not as simple in manufacture of modems to go to large-scale integration as it is in computers, because many things are inherently analog. Now, and analog things are not so easy to make an integrated circuits as in the air control. So you are using Warren's time. I'm finishing. The next slide shows the kind of an evolution that's going on in data sets. You see all the junk pile at the right being replaced by the single car at the left using integrated circuits. And, of course, that's going on everywhere. The next slide, then, shows... it's not going to show very much unless you sit in front, I guess. Shows what's happening to something that's inherently analog. And this is the adaptive equalizer, which is a very complicated piece of equipment. And you see the big stack of piles in the background. That's only 1/4 of the adaptive equalizer as it was built a few years ago. Now, the single card, as you see a couple way down, is the way it is made right now. The little card is the way that 1/4 of adaptive equalizer is built in the new wideband sets. And finally, underneath the magnifying glass that nobody at all can see is a single chip that the whole thing is being put on right now. And the way this was done was by taking something that was analog and changing it over to digital. And I think you'll see that done throughout the data modems. Everything, the filtering operation now will be done digital. We're going to come right into the modem, do analog to digital conversion, and then the modem itself will sort of become a special purpose digital computer. And the only difference then you'll see between the computer per se and the modem perhaps is a function which they do. The modem will do signal processing, the computer will do the service operations on the data. So this is the trend in data transmission, and Warren Cornell now is going to tell you more about the variety and flexibility in the systems, the computer communication systems, which are becoming available. Thank you.
You're now about to hear a talk from the other end of the horse. This bell will probably ring. Before I go down, I'll stop talking. I only got two. I'm going to confine my remarks to three technical areas of computer communication systems. My approach to computers from the communication viewpoint is to talk about trends as I see them in computer communication systems. What I want to talk about is what we're learning about today to help plan better data communications, what things are coming into being now, the present trends, and what we can look forward to in the future. Current studies are yielding very useful traffic information on the design of systems. We're learning something about macroscopic things like calling rates and holding times, but more important, we're learning something about the microscopic information, the details of the characteristics of the information flow, the effects of computer load on traffic flow, the effects of computer scheduling algorithms. These are points that Dave Evans made in opening and that Sam Estes mentioned in his time series statistics that he indicated we needed to get. As part of this study, we've made extensive measurements on four interactive time-sharing systems, commercial systems. And if I can have the first slide, I'll show you what the model looks like that we constructed of these systems. It consists of course, a dialogue of information flowing back and forth between the computer and the user, and made up of alternate transmissions and bursts of information first from the user and then from the computer, with things like think time, where the line is completely idle here, and then computer delays, and a summary of what you get when you analyze in the neighborhood of 20,000 pieces of information over four different systems is shown in the next slide. What it says is that on the average for these systems, we see something like, on a moderately loaded system, 20 minutes of holding time for a typical connection. 11 minutes, over half of this is user delay. Computer send time is about a third, about 7 minutes. And computer delay accounts for a small amount, about a minute, and user send time, about a minute. Very little information being sent in. Now, increase the load on the computer to where the user has to wait for his information. computer delay goes up to 17 minutes, and the overall holding time goes up to 34 minutes, almost double what it was. Well, we're also now beginning to measure short holding time, inquiry response type systems. If you're interested in knowing more about this, there'll be a talk at the Spring Joint Computer Conference by Jackson and Stubbs called A Study of Multi-Access Communications. Well, there are three trends evident in communications for computers today. They're shown on the next slide. They are increased data rates for voice band and wideband circuits, and increased alternatives to meet specific needs, and lower costs. And speeds are going up on DDD and private line voice band services, and Bob Luckey's covered that very well. Similar techniques are applicable to wideband. If you'll just switch on the next slide, I'll hit a couple of points on that. On group band circuits, 48 kilohertz, the present 40 and 50 kilobit speeds are going up to 72 and 108 kilobits. And on T1 carrier, the present speeds of about a half a megabit are going up to over a megabit. In addition to private line, which these services are, higher speed switch services are becoming available, such as the one shown in the next slide, which is Dataphone 50, now being provided on an experimental basis between New York, Washington, Chicago, and LA. This is very useful where either the volume of traffic doesn't justify a private line connection, or where the traffic from a given terminal has to distribute over many points. As a point of reference here, the break-even point on the calls between, say, New York and Chicago is such that a switched service, on-demand service, is cheaper if you have less than about 3 hours of information to send in a day. That's about a half a billion bits of information. The second trend I want to mention is increased alternatives to meet specific needs. For example, originate-only, manually operated data sets are becoming available for use at remote consoles. Terminate-only data sets available for computer sites. And these can be built with about a third of the complexity of the data sets that we've had to use in the past. Better matches to computer traffic characteristics can be had in asymmetrical data set capability, which is being provided by some of the sets that Bob Luckey mentioned. For example, 3,600 bits per second in one direction with simultaneous 150 in the other direction over a two-wire connection with no complicated channel turnaround algorithms having to be built into the communication controller or the terminals. Another example of increased alternatives is special arrangements to meet particular needs. There's a new system on which a trial is getting underway at Dartmouth College, which we call Datrex. It's shown in the next view graph. It takes advantage of the natural clustering of stations in systems such as industrial complexes and hospitals and university campuses to save transmission costs, including data set costs. The idea here is that by providing concentrators, as shown here, one can efficiently load the computer ports, and they're not cheap, by the way. We made a survey of all sorts of computer ports, and if you sort of average things out, the average rental of a low-speed 150-bit port is going to cost you around $50 a month. So you want to be able to distribute over them, use them in large trunk groups. You want to be able to concentrate from 2 to 4 times as many stations. With something like 3 miles between the stations and the computers, one can use a data set at the station that has about a tenth of the complexity of a normal data set. This sort of system meets the needs where many stations have a favorite computer, and this indeed is true in many stations. However, we get the complicating factor that every once in a while one of these stations wants to reach the outside world. It wants to go somewhere else. In the past, we've had to provide full capability to do this all the time to meet transmission requirements for long haul. In such a system as this, we can concentrate the fancier transmission circuits at the output of the concentrator, and a station is shown below the CON on concentrator there, for example. If it has occasional need to go outside, can go outside through the concentrator into the DDD network, and it has the whole network at its disposal to reach any place it wants to go. In the lower left here, you see things like remote clusters of stations that are not near any computer at all, which can be brought in on private line arrangements. Some of the features that are being included in this system are off-hook selection, no dialing to get to the computer, camp-on capability, so that when you reach all computer ports busy, instead of being frustrated and having to hang up and try again, and you don't know when to try again, you just hang on and you're connected through as soon as a port becomes available. Things like computer callback to selected stations as required. And Sam Estes mentioned needing priority in systems. And one of the ways you can get priority is to give the computer a little more control over what's going on here. So this system can take any one of its incoming trunks and deny traffic to it. It can also disconnect trunks at will if it needs to. All for that slide now. For the future, we see a continuation of these trends and an increasing use of digital carrier, which Bob Luckey covered. One thing I'd like to say, a couple of things about digital carrier. The T1 system, for example, today, without waiting for a greater spread of it throughout the system, is able to handle 850 kilobit channels in the place of 24 voice channels. This is a 3-to-1 trade-off on 50 kilobit channels. On analog facilities, you only get a 12-to-1 trade-off.